Welcome to those who are here when we're recording live and to those watching later. I'm Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. I'm one of the executive team members on the staff of the UUMA. I'm the Director of Ministries for Collegial Care. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm grateful to be hosting today and to have planned this gathering with my colleague, Sarah Lammer. Sarah, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, everybody. It's really wonderful to see this great turnout. I'm the Reverend Sarah Lammert. I serve as co-director of Ministries and Faith Development at the UUA alongside of Dr. Janice Marie Johnson. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm eager to jump into this conversation.
We'd like to take a moment to light a chalice. And so I invite you to light yours along with me if you have one, or just light the chalice in your heart. I offer you these words from M. Jade Kaiser, from Infleshed. God is like a movement. God is like a movement, love growing, rowdy with aspiration, adapting and creating in the directions of liberation, using beauty to inspire, painting dreams across creation, feeding the bread of life to all who hunger for justice, weary, but alive with hope, fueled with tears and grit and memories of saints past, going nose to nose with evil, planted firmly in truth, working, writing, singing, arrests and threats, slander and shame, it's sacred labor. But laughter too. Whatever you have to bring is enough. Loaves and fishes are made into feasts. Can you hear the invitation? It extends to all who desire freedom. In our gathering today, we want to just take a moment to remember our covenant. So we are bound in covenant as members of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association. You can see the words on your screen. Maybe keep yourself muted, but read along with me. United in our call to serve the spirit of love and justice through the vocation of ministry in the liberal religious tradition, we, the members of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, covenant with one another to conduct ourselves with integrity, honoring the trust placed in us, to embody in our lives the values we proclaim on behalf of our faith, to support one another in collegial respect and care, understanding and honoring the diversity within our association, to hold ourselves accountable to each other for the competent exercise of our vocation, to use our power constructively and with intention, mindful of our potential unconsciously to perpetuate systems of oppression, to seek justice and right relations according to our evolving collective wisdom, and to refrain from all abuse or exploitation, to cultivate practices of deepening awareness, understanding, humility, and commitment to our ideals, to labor earnestly together for the well-being of our communities and the progress of Unitarian Universalism. Through fidelity to this covenant and our code of professional conduct, we aspire to grow in wholeness and bring hope and healing to the world. And in addition to the aspirations contained in our covenant and the commitments named therein, I'd like to offer you these guidelines, which probably many, if not most of you, have seen before. We've been gratefully sharing these guidelines in many gatherings in the UMA. They come from Meg Wheatley's Turning to One Another. And so just some specific invitations for this collegial conversation. Let's acknowledge one another as equals. Try to stay curious about each other. Recognize that we need each other's help to become better listeners. Slow down so we have time to think and reflect. Remember that conversation is a natural way humans think together, and expect it to be messy at times. So we'll share those in the chat as well, those guidelines for our conversation. And I invite all of us to help keep the guidelines and remember the covenant as we engage in this collegial conversation. For those who'd like to know where we're going, we'll start with some preliminary sharing of the results of the FACT survey that Sarah Lambert's going to share with us. We'll have time for small group conversation and then return for large group conversation. I'll turn it over to you, Sarah.
Okay. Well, I hope many of you had a chance to review the video that was made by several colleagues who work in different roles at the UUA as well as the UUMA. And thank you to those of you who are here today who contributed to that video. If you didn't see it, it's linked to the invitation to this. And I would just recommend that you take a look at that when you have time. It's about 30 minutes. I am currently the liaison to FACT, which is stands for Faith Communities Today. It's a data collecting organization that comes out of what used to be called Hartford Seminary and is now Hartford University for Religious and Peace Studies. And the UUA has been participating in FACT for several decades now. This particular survey, which I thank those of you who helped to fill out, is really dedicated to looking at how congregations in the United States are doing coming out of the pandemic. We had an excellent response rate to the survey. We had 537 complete surveys filled out. So that, I think, is a record. The FACT folks have not had a chance yet to do all of the evaluations of the data that's come in from every faith tradition. But I just want to put it on your radar that that should be coming out by August. And so it'll be very interesting to see what this preliminary look at our UU data, which I'm about to share with you, how that stacks up against how other denominations or religious traditions are faring. So I'm going to share my screen now and take you through a presentation on the data that we collected. So I don't think it'll be a shock to anyone to see that in-person attendance declined during the pandemic and has remained at a lower rate than it was in 2018. And you can see that the mean went down from 86 to 64, which represents a 25% decline. The good news is that thanks to all of you and the good people in our congregations who volunteer and work on our staffs, people pivoted very quickly during the pandemic, and UU congregations offering online options increased from only 7% in 2018 to 93% in 2023. So way to go. What this actually means is that the total combined attendance of people in person and online did not decline. It actually went up from a mean of 88 to a mean of 93. And as the Reverend Matthew Johnson, who helped me look through this data and analyze it, noted, this is remarkable. Our fast pivot to the online options supported by the UUA and each other means that even though there are less people physically in our church buildings, we are reaching more people than we did before. So that's a sign of hope. So again, 537 congregations are represented in these numbers, but I think this is fairly accurate. 65% of our congregations have one clergy person. Of those, about 70% are full-time. Only 10% have more than one clergy. 16% are lay-led, and the rest are either in between ministers or for some reason chose none of the above. Which may mean that they have a staff person, not 100% volunteer or lay-led, but maybe they just have one staff. This is the gender that was reported of our ministers, which I think has remained fairly steady over the years, but that's what people are reporting right now. And this survey, by the way, was done in March and April.
So this is very new data.
Now, I'm not sure what happened here, but we only received responses in this category for 68% of the people. But you can see what was reported here.
So in the past, I believe our average minister had been in their pulpit for seven years. That has declined to six years, so it looks like there's more movement going on.
Interesting, and positively, 97% of congregations recorded either a good or very good match with their minister.
Since 2020, 7% of new ministers have seriously doubted their calling,
while 18% often considered leaving parish ministry.
While these numbers are high, they're certainly not as high as interfaith partners.
And then finally, parish ministers are rating themselves at a 7.6 out of 10 on their overall health, physical and mental health,
and 6.9 out of 10 on their financial health.
So it's not horrific, but we have some room for growth there.
This is our UU congregational participation by age.
And I'll provide a link to this presentation to you all so you can have this.
This is a congregational participation by race and ethnicity.
And I'll give you a moment to take this slide in.
These are the percentages that agreed with these statements.
I'm not going to read each one of them because I believe you can see them, although perhaps it would be good to get them in different methods, so I will read them quickly.
Has a clear mission of 73%, striving to be diverse is 80%, is good at welcoming 83%.
Interestingly, is actively looking for members only 68% agreed with that statement.
Is spiritually vital and alive 72%.
Changes to meet new challenges 78%.
And again, that's surprisingly low, is involved in the local community 66%.
So when I look at this, I see many are self-perception statements, and those tend to be higher, but when it comes to action steps, like actively looking for members or actively involved in the local community, those percentages dip a little bit.
I made a word cloud out of the concerns that people expressed, people had a chance to actually write some words into the survey.
And I would say that the biggest concerns are finances, declining membership, burnout, conflict, and aging volunteer populations.
But we do celebrate many strengths, our ability to undertake transformation. The most common thing was that worship is very satisfying in many congregations, and that people are open to innovation and are proud of what they were able to accomplish during the pandemic.
Music, justice organizing, these are all other values that we hold dear. So we asked the congregations to say how many percentage of them hold these kinds of programs in person, and then the next slide will show you how many are offering these programs online or in a hybrid fashion.
I was actually heartened to see that 70% are reporting that they have a Sunday school.
Although I will note that this has been a tough week in the religious education sphere, and a lot of religious educators are reporting that their positions have been eliminated.
Or reduced.
48% of our congregations are holding in-person youth groups,
even though only 4% of the population were youth.
Online or hybrid, not many Sunday school options online.
More for adult RE.
And interestingly, youth groups, only 6% of our congregations are doing anything online or hybrid youth groups or young adults groups. This chart represents the congregation's use of technology.
So we see that email is still popular.
It takes up too much of our time.
We have monthly e-news.
Only 28% of congregations regularly use texting.
ACH means electronic transfer funds.
It's a way to electronically transfer funds.
Use regular use of social media,
doing video projection, online audio,
and then website and Facebook.
So there you see it.
This is how our congregations are spending their money.
I would have guessed that staff costs were higher.
But they are 53%.
And building costs are still a huge amount, 26%.
This financial health from 2018 to 2023 reflects the seriousness of our financial challenges right now.
The tight but we manage has stayed relatively the same.
But in some difficulty or in serious difficulty has gone up a lot.
While those reporting that they have a good situation with their finances has declined significantly.
Those who had excellent finances before continue to have excellent finances today.
I think that represents probably congregations that have significant endowments.
This will be very interesting to see how this matches up with other denominations and faith traditions.
I note that there was a lot of conflict and disagreement during the pandemic.
Only about 46% said yes, but not serious or no conflict.
Which means that over half of our congregations had conflicts that were so serious that either a clergy person left.
That was 9.4%.
Some people withheld pledges.
Or some members resigned over the conflict.
Interestingly, the destructive tension surrounding social and political issues was not as high.
And in fact declined in some cases.
I hope this means that our particular intra-UU tensions around free expression of free speech, the so-called gadfly, a shorthand for that.
Has not been able to penetrate and cause too many conflicts in congregations, although they may have been involved in the others.
We remain an optimistic people.
Most people reporting in this survey feel either somewhat or very positive about the future.
And we're coming up to the last couple slides here. Our congregation is emerging from the pandemic stronger than before.
That's all over the map, but still fairly strong from either agree or disagree through strongly agree.
Would be the majority.
As a result of the pandemic, we're thinking anyway about our mission.
A lot of congregations agree with that.
And finally, this congregation has identified and embraced many new opportunities for ministry since the pandemic.
Again, a very strong response to that.
And I think that is in large part thanks to you, my colleagues, and your leadership. So I'm going to stop sharing. I see there's a lot going on in the chat, but I haven't been able to follow that. So I will pause to see if we had any questions that need responding to before we move on.
Sarah, I have documented the questions.
Okay, great.
The first one is, can we have access to these slides to share?
Yes.
And can they be shared with congregation?
Yes. Yeah, you all filled it out, so you can use the data.
Okay. And who was the survey marketed to? Was this just Unitarian Universalist congregations?
So each denomination or religious that's a member of FACT has a liaison. That was me. I was responsible for actually sending out and dealing with this survey. And so there's a person from each other denomination. And we did ours. I think we were one of the first to complete it. So I know the UCC have already completed theirs, but I haven't seen their results. But we should have that by August. So keep an eye on their website, because all their surveys are available there for free for anyone to use.
Okay. Thank you. And do you have an idea of who answered these surveys? Were they ministers, staff, lay people?
Yes, they were sent to the minister, the board president, and the administrator where those were available. And these folks were asked to work together to create one survey, because we could only allow one survey from any given congregation.
Thank you. And how was financial health evaluated?
Yes, this is just, I'm sorry, just you responses, Olivia. Okay. Jan, go ahead.
It's not fair putting questions in there while I'm trying. Fine. How is financial health evaluated? What defines the categories?
If someone's interested in seeing the survey, I can send you a copy. Just ping me and I'll send it to you.
Okay. And people were wondering if that music ministry did not seem to show up in these questions, and if there's some way of how is music ministry being assessed?
I don't believe they asked that many questions about music ministry, but I'll go back and look and make sure I didn't miss some data that I could share.
Okay. And anything that you can point to as a source on changes with religious education positions?
So when I was speaking anecdotally, but every year we do a credentialing survey, the UUA, when people turn in their credentialing, they also turn in data there. And Jan Gartner also just did a survey on staffing in UU congregations. So we have that, but I don't have all that at the top of, right at my fingertips right now.
Okay. I think I have covered the questions that people put in the chat.
Okay. Feel free to follow up with me, colleagues, slammert@uua.org, if you have other specific questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. And thank you, Jan. And I want to thank Joanna Lupkin, who is our tech support for today. And we're really grateful for that help. Joanna's going to be starting to put you in breakout groups. So first, I want to assure you that we know that we all have many relationships in many different contexts. So if you find that you've been placed in a breakout group that isn't a good match for you today, you can just come back to this room and we will reassign you to another room with no questions asked. So we hope that alleviates any concerns about the smallness of our Unitarian Universalist collegial world. As that gets prepared, I just want to say a couple words. Some of you may recall that years ago, there was a gathering like this in the spring, reporting on the state of the ministry. And Sarah and I, as we were talking this winter, thought, you know what? We cannot report on the state of the ministry. It's in so much flux, and the trends are so dynamically evolving that this needs to be a collegial conversation in which we all report from our spheres about what are the dynamics and current trends in parish ministry. So that's what we'd like to do now in this small group opportunity, is give you a chance to say, in addition to everything that you just heard from the results from the FACT survey, in addition to all of our colleagues working for various institutions who spoke in the video that you saw, what else do you know about the dynamics and trends in parish ministry that hasn't been named that you want to add to the conversation or that you really want to underscore. So you will have 20 minutes in small groups of six. We ask you to choose a timekeeper so that everybody gets at least 2 minutes to share. Everyone's voice will be in the conversation. And then you can use the remaining time to talk amongst yourselves about anything that really strikes you as a significant point that emerges in your group, that a major takeaway, or questions that emerge in your group that you'd like to bring back to the larger group conversation time. So again, you'll have 20 minutes, groups of six. You can come back here if your group is not a good match for you, and we'll reassign you. Choose a timekeeper so everybody gets 2 minutes to share what you know about dynamics or current trends that feel important to name. And then a little time at the end so that you can discuss as a group what you'd like to bring back. We won't be able to hear from every group because there's so many of us, but we will have a time when we return to hear from some of the groups. So if there's something that really feels important to your small group to name back to this larger group, you'll have an opportunity when we return before we move into a larger conversation. So if you have questions, please put them in the chat. Thanks for your question, Laura, about if you need a recorder. It would be great if you could come out of that group with a sentence that you'll either speak into the room or put in the chat so that we can compile your observations and reflect and share them with all of our colleagues who can't be here today. Okay, so are we ready to move into breakouts, Joanna?
We are. Let me open the rooms.
Joanna Lepkin points out that the recording has put a sentence or two in the chat about the major takeaways. And then if you do want to report out from your group, raise your hand and I'll call on you. We'll do this for a few minutes before we turn to larger conversation and time for questions. Reverend Nika.
Hi, all. Thank you so much. We had an interesting discussion where the main thing that came out was that we need to figure out how to make church relevant and how to innovate going forward. And we discussed that it would be really great to have some kind of think tank discussion on that with colleagues on a larger scale so that we're not all trying to figure out how on earth we make church relevant to families, for example, or to young people and so on these days. So whatever we could do as a UUMA to really brainstorm together would be really helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. Matthew, and then Sarah, and let me just encourage others, if you want to report out from your breakout, use that raised hand feature, because there's so many screens, it will be easier to find you. Matthew.
We had a great conversation, and one takeaway was that for congregations that are having a hard time financially or trauma-wise or transitional-wise from the pandemic or from pre-existing issues, there's too much expectation for ministers, and particularly new ministers, to solve that problem on their own rather than for the congregation to take leadership of that. And so problems are exacerbated without that support that those congregations need. And we're not all miracle workers. In fact, none of us are by ourselves.
Thank you. Sarah Stewart and then Sarah Person.
Our group had very different experiences. A couple of us shared that that church is thriving. Because one church is a center for religious liberalism in Texas, because ministries were established before the pandemic, because finances are strong. There was an Aspern who said that most of her peers are prepping for chaplaincy or community ministry, and that she would find it hard to move her family for short-term work. One member of our group said that after pastor dynamics are making her ministry hard, and another shared her real struggle after a negotiated resignation during the pandemic.
Thank you. Sarah Person and then Lucas.
Great conversation. Thank you, folks. There were, in addition to some of the things that have already been mentioned, talking about just sort of care and support of folks entering into ministry The debt load versus the salaries is a tremendous disparity. And the financial stress has just intensified since the pandemic. It's stress not only on the clergy, but on the congregations. We also just talked about, in general, Keith Cron's recent note to us, which just eloquently represented the sort of the atmosphere that we're working in. And lastly, was there a way to get sufficient support from the growing percentage of people who are participating remotely with the congregation? Is there a way that we can innovate to reach out and get support from those folks?
Thank you. Lucas and then Kim.
Great. Yeah, wonderful, wonderful conversation. And it's been so helpful to hear from my colleagues. We named a couple of things that we sort of saw as trends. One is that, you know, during the pandemic, many of us, you know, felt that there was kind of a winnowing out of some of the programs and opportunities that our congregations were hosting and offering. And many of those have not come back since then. And so there's been some sense of urgency that, you know, some people feeling like, oh, I got to step in and like kind of make that happen, or how do we make that happen? And then also kind of noticing that there's not as many volunteers. Many of us have, you know, sort of noticed that there's just kind of like not the level of support in terms of volunteerism that we, you know, experienced before the pandemic. Some people did mention that there were some helpful opportunities that have been sort of emerging since the pandemic, though, that are sort of new seeds and new possibilities and some joyful connections that people have been having. So, you know, it's not like it's all been awful either. And then I thought kind of an interesting note that we ended on is that many of us were sort of talking about whether it's interfaith collegial groups or whether it's clusters, just less participation in terms of like those collegial connections. Like I was mentioning one group that kind of went from 30 colleagues down to like two, and other people were naming some similar things. So just something to notice, no judgment being passed, just curiosity. Thank you.
So appreciate you saying that. And I just take a moment of liberty to say that I'm actually working on a little summary about the state of our chapters to share with our board. And I'm seeing the same thing that you just named. And we have asked each chapter to give us some feedback. So if your chapter has not done that yet, you know, because you got an email from us, and we'd love your responses. Kim.
Thanks. One of the things that we found we all had in common was that there had been a tremendous amount of staff turnover in our congregations. In some cases, it was music related, but for almost all of us, we had staff turnover in religious education. And I know that there's a lot happening greater right now. This week,
There's some trouble with your sound, and we're catching like every fifth word. I'm wondering if there's an adjustment you can make. No. If you put what you want to say in the chat, I will read it out. Thank you. So we have about half an hour left. We appreciate those of you who have spoken to report out from your group, and also recognize that many of you have posted in the chat. We will save the chat and share it and invite people who are working in leadership in various institutions to reflect on your observations. We do want to have time for a larger group conversation, which of course is tricky in a group of this size. So we are going to use the progressive stack, which is a way of centering those whose voices are too often marginalized in our community. And if you have something to share, either a question or a comment, you can let Jan Taddeo know, who you can find Jan's name in the chat. Jan is going to keep a list of who wishes to speak. Comments are welcome. Questions are welcome. Many of the people who contributed to the video that you viewed in advance are on the call today. Most of them, not everyone though. So if you have a question, if you could say who it's directed to, then maybe we can figure out if there's someone on this call who would be well positioned to answer. And if you have a comment, let us know that it's a comment, so we're clear that we're not trying to find someone to respond to. So again, a half an hour. Message Jan if you want to be in the queue. Let Jan know if you are in the progressive stack. It's by self-identification. And you can either make a comment or a question. While we're waiting, we can all take a look at what has been posted in the chat. Right, Julie. So if for people who are trying to figure out how to say that you wish to speak, if you click on participants, then you can see Jan's name, and then you can private message Jan to get on the list to speak. This will enable us to use the progressive stack. I thought that there'd be more people who wanted to speak than time, which is why we're trying it this way, but we'll just give it another minute. And if that's not the case, then we'll just open up more generally. All right, then, seeing no names coming forward, go ahead and just use the raise hand feature. I am quite sure.
I now have someone in the progressive stack.
Okay.
So Crystal Zerfoss.
Should I go ahead?
Yeah.
Thanks. I know there's been talk, and I don't know who this question would be directed to, so I'm sorry, Melissa. Can you shed any light on where we are in collecting information or putting together something that's compiling a list of or information about congregations who have mistreated ministers? I know there's been a lot of talk about this new focus on that. When we've talked about after pastor congregations, but now talking about congregations who have actually treated ministers poorly.
Megan Foley, I'm going to ask you to say a word, but before I do, I just want to say that I have just asked Christine Purcell, who works for Transitions and works with the special care congregations, if she'd be willing to write a newsletter article about that designation and how it's going for our members. And Christine said yes. So that'll be forthcoming in a UMA weekly. But for today, Megan, what might you offer in response?
It's hard to know where to start. I guess I just want to say that we're not trying to create a list of congregations that have mistreated ministers because, you know, that's a fluid situation, right? So like, toxic situations happen, behavior happens on either side. These situations are often very complicated. So the short answer to the question of where is such a list is actually the way to find out the background of a congregation at any time is to be please, please, please always talking to your UUA field staff about the congregations. I know that, well, you all remember us when you're in trouble, which is fantastic, but I also really want you to remember us when like all the time in search, all the time, because as you can imagine, you have like 40 some odd people, often your colleagues, who have been spending years, their careers, in relationship with these congregations. They know them backwards and forwards. And so there never needs to be a secret about what kind of situation you're getting into. And unfortunately, it's never black or white, like this is a terrible congregation that mistreats ministers. Occasionally we have that, but we usually are pretty proactive at that point of warning you, or we try to be. Usually there's something in the middle where we're trying to find a match between your desire to serve in the world and their needs. And I think almost all of us have experienced a situation where, sure, the congregation was going to need work. And I mean, the whole point of ministry is you're going to a place that wants to do certain things with themselves and in the world, right? And you're trying to find a way that that fits with your own call to ministry. And that's true when the congregation is particularly damaged and when it's particularly healthy. So if you take one thing away from me, it is call your field staff all the time. We are paid to receive your calls. You are not bothering us. We want to talk to you, and we know a ton of stuff about congregations. So, and that's the thing to keep an eye out for in any search process, and when you're in a congregation and starting to experience trouble too. I'm not sure that exactly answers your question.
Thank you. It doesn't quite, but I appreciate your response. Thank you.
I do know a bit about special care congregations as well. So the shorthand on that is that Christine is creating a way in which congregations that have the shorthand has gone through ministers, but had this a pattern of continued short-term ministries for sort of a pattern that we can all see are being offered enough or being kept out of the settled search process and having some intentional time of really working with field staff and other UUA and UUMA staff to see what their needs are around their plans for the next ministry. I had like a little bit of a tangent there that has just flown out of my head. But again, the goal around that, part of a very significant part of the goal around that is that no minister goes into that place without knowing everything about that history and committing to being able to, you know, willing to work in that environment. And I think that's what's fallen short in the past, is that some of these congregations where you see the same thing again and again, like the next person just like they come up like and they don't know what they're getting into, and it's the same deal. And they didn't know what they were getting into, and it's the same deal. And there's some sort of weird kismet around dysfunctional relationships where they're drawing the same kind of folks who do the same kind of thing and the same kind of reaction. It just repeats and repeats and repeats, like everybody needs a big congregational therapist. And so we want to interrupt that. If nothing else, we want to interrupt that by making sure at least any future clergy go in there knowing what the deal is.
Thanks, Megan. And I can tell you, Christine said that there are 10 such congregations as of last week when she replied to my query. So more on that forthcoming in a weekly news. Reverend Tara? Tara?
It's Tara. Thank you. And thanks for that, Megan. Something you just brought up sparked something that's also on my mind, which is just this reality about new ministers getting thrown into complete hot messes, because that's all that's available to us. And I'm in that situation right now. And most of my clergy friends who are in my cohort are in a similar situation. And I just wonder, we have the information, and you know, when looking for congregations, like people who are newer to ministry can see, whoa, this is going to end poorly. But because congregations don't want to hire new people, especially if they are perceived to be young and new, it doesn't matter what we do or don't know about the congregation, because there are only options. So like all the information can be out there, but you know, all those congregations that seem to have some stability and some ability to be supportive want people who are mid-career, and that's just kind of a self-perpetuating cycle. So I don't know, that's on my heart, and it makes me sad. And I don't, you know, of course, have a solution, and I don't think any of us do. The other thing that has come up a lot in trust in our group of trans and non-binary colleagues lately is that a couple of years ago, there was a lot of celebration about, you know, there's been more trans and non-binary ministers getting settled positions than ever before. And someone pointed out in a group this past week that 4 out of the 5 of those from that celebration are ending. And that's the reality right now, that we're getting people with marginalized identities into positions and we're not keeping them there. Why? I think the why is obvious. But one of the particularities right now, I think, with that situation is that, in particular with trans issues and pronoun issues, unless the congregation has enough money to get adequate training to be able to equip the congregation to keep those ministers and avoid microaggressions, it's completely up to the trans or non-binary minister to do that work. Because it's easy to say, well, oh, we'll have Transforming Hearts come in, or have that cost $2,000, and most congregations don't have $2,000. So in the face of that truth, it's, you know, it's us, and we're like, okay, well, I guess I'll be the one to do the training. And then we're like a prime target for, you know, all that comes out of the experience of being uncomfortable. So that's where I'm at. And I just think it's a lot to think about. And I also really appreciate this conversation. So I'll hand it over to Sarah.
Thank you, Tara. Really important naming. I wanted to just check with you. Are you hoping for a response from somebody, or did you want to just have
No, not necessarily. Thank you, though.
Let's go to Angeline Jackson next.
So I have more of a comment than anything else.
Angeline, can you adjust your microphone a little bit? A little closer to your mouth, maybe.
I can. Is that better? Yeah, it did a switch. So it's more of a comment than anything else, and kind of musings from seminary, fresh out of seminary, like Sunday fresh. And so just a lot of this is just comments. I've noticed even in the presentation, the PowerPoint, that age range of 7%, 18 to 34, that we have in our congregations, and the thoughts of what is normal, returning to a previous normal, and the struggles with or opposition to technology in so many of our congregational spaces. I think where I'm going is that, you know, as the world continues to move, as normal continues to shift, and as people find that online connections can be meaningful, I would love to see a greater engagement, interaction, something where innovative ministry is not separate as innovative ministry, but can have conversations with parish ministry and community ministry and other forms of ministry. Because if we're going to grow, if we're going to move from stagnant, if we're going to, all the things that we want to see as a vision for our faith, I personally believe that we need those spaces of innovation. And not that as parish ministers, we're not innovative, but that sometimes folks from the outside can see that innovation in different ways that we may not see when we're, you know, looking at the wall. And as much spaghetti as we can throw, sometimes there's just not, we're not thinking of, I don't know, we need a different sauce brand to make it stick. And so just wanting to lift up that, just that space of how we can make more dialogue between specifically innovative ministry and the other forms of ministry, so that this 18 to 34, 7% that always generally comes back when they have families, that we have that bridge between the leaving and the returning, and probably increasing that number, and therefore, yeah, growing our faith at the end of the day. So thank you.
Thank you. Angeline, did you want someone to respond to any of that, or again, just speaking?
It's more of a comment. I mean, if there's a response, I'll take it, but it's more of a comment.
Thank you. I don't see anyone rushing to respond, so let's go next to Julie Stoneberg.
Thanks, Melissa. This is kind of a forward-looking thing, I think. I guess I feel like as a fish swimming in my own water and having become in this part of my life and dedicated religiously, that when I think about the times we're in, to me, it feels like all of the messaging around anxiety around AI and isolation and people needing community and all of these kind of things, that there's this, in me, a natural impulse to say, well, why aren't people just flooding in our doors? You know, this kind of why, and I get that there's a reason that they're not, but then what's the alternative? Like it feels like there's such a natural, to me, fit for people coming into our communities to help to provide some kind of a balm for those things, but people aren't. So where are they going, or where are they turning, or what are they doing? And those questions, which I'm sure are on everybody's minds about, so how do we shift what we're doing and how we present it? Maybe it means we don't meet in church buildings anymore. Maybe it means, I don't even know what it means. But that's, I guess, just my putting it out there. We think about this. It's not that people don't need, aren't spiritual anymore. It's not that people don't need community anymore. So just what do those questions mean for us in our future? And I'm not also looking for necessarily a response, just putting out that question that I'm sure is on many of our minds. That's it.
Thank you. And I appreciate the interplay, the resonance between your question and Angeline's. And going to turn now to Sarah. Tell us if you have a comment or a question, Sarah Stewart.
I just want to, I've got a comment and then a question. I want to lift up what Tara said, because one solution to needing ministers who are more able to move, especially for a first ministry, would be to recruit young adults who don't yet have children, or perhaps don't own a house, or maybe are just at a stage in their life where moving is easier. But then we need to support young adults in the ministry if we're going to do that. So my question is for Keith, who I don't even know if he's here, but is there any consideration about making the search process shorter in general, easier for congregations, less time-consuming and less expensive? If it works for short-term ministries, can it work for longer-term ministries?
Is it okay to jump in, Melissa?
Please, yes.
We're recommending to every congregation under 125, I could make it 150, that they go to a contract ministry search, as opposed to going through the settled search process. As a way to do this, in terms of making the overall search process shorter, I will just say that I am open to ideas. I think that this, and I also think this has to be a collective decision. It can't be me sort of making it. I think it has to come from colleagues. I think it has to come from congregations. I think it has to be something that there is a common desire to see happen on some level. I'm very worried that so many of our searches have become so geographically restricted. Because so often ministry is a second income or at best a co-equal income in a house. So many people restricted by families. It's all very complicated. And I will just say I'm open to conversations and ideas that I hope that we can all have about this. But we started by 6 or 7 years ago saying if you weren't full-time, you were a contract ministry search. And now we're moving toward 125 or less. I mean, the drain on leadership volunteers in small congregations is rough. And yet, how do we help congregation through a transitional process? Because when they don't have one, it also is problematic. Great question.
Thank you.
There's some comments for, I think, you, especially in the chat, Keith, in response. And I'll just mention that in another collegial gathering, someone last week wondered if we have more and more ministers who are geographically bound, can we rearrange the way we do search to have more geographical matches? So I'll just add that pondering to the mix. Who's next? Jamie Hinson, Uyghur.
Thank you. This is comment that is also a question, and it's comes from something that Reverend Dr. Jennifer Kwong said in the 30-minute video, that the number of people who get to the MFC who are affirmed in fellowship has dropped to 70%. And, you know, as ministers being oftentimes the first person that a person reaches out to, like, hey, I'm feeling this call. Can you talk to me about this? I would feel really conflicted about counseling someone to go through the incredible amount of, you know, effort and expense to get to the MFC, knowing that right now almost 1 in 3 are not being affirmed in fellowship. And so the question is, do we know why that number has dropped? Do we think this is just a short-term response to coming out of the last 3 years, or is this a new normal, or what is going on here? Thank you.
I think I can speak to that, Jamie. Thank you for raising that. It is startling. I think during the pandemic, it became harder to complete the formation process. And so we had a lot of people actually put off their MFC interviews. And in some cases, some folks who came before the committee may have just come too soon. So not all these 30% were denied ever becoming a minister. Some of them were just asked to fulfill some contingencies, and some were asked to return for another conversation with the MFC. And I believe that will be an opportunity to speak with the MFC at General Assembly. They'll have some kind of a conversational topic, and you can get their direct impressions. I just serve as a staff person, not as a member of the MFC.
Thank you for the comments and question and your response, Sarah. We have about 10 minutes left, and we have a closing prayer from Sarah. So I think if we're lucky, we'll be able to take these last two questions. Matthew, you're next.
Thanks, Melissa, and thanks, everybody. I do have a comment that leads to a question as well. And it's based, you know, partly on what Keith was just mentioning about needing that wider conversation in order to make changes to the process. We've been having these conversations in hallways at General Assembly and, you know, at the bar and at the, you know, morning walk at their ministers' retreats for 10 years. I mean, I think it's been clear probably since 2011 or 12 that this train was going to arrive at this station. And it got here way faster than any of us thought because of the pandemic. But the structure by which we're doing what we're doing, from recruitment to credentialing, to fellowshipping, to settlement, to support for new ministers, is not working. I mean, I think we all know that. And I think the video made that really clear. And the phrase are showing up in ways, of course, that put people with more marginalized identities at greater risk, unsurprisingly. So this has been coming for a while. So I guess my question is, what is the container for the conversation about not tweaks, but radical, creative thinking about how we might do this differently? And in a way we probably maybe haven't done it since 1961, right? right, really differently. What is the process by which that happens? Because I don't think it's just a UUMA conversation. It's very clearly not just a UUA staff conversation. I don't think they feel empowered to have that conversation amongst themselves alone, and they shouldn't, and they're right about that. But as we know, our lay people are mostly exhausted. So we can't get them to make coffee, let alone think about the structure of ministerial settlements and recruitment, right? So, but what is the container for having this conversation? Because we clearly need to have it. And I don't know who that question is directed to, you know, maybe Melissa yourself and also maybe Sarah a little bit, but what's the next step here?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll start, and I'd love for you to jump in, Sarah, or anybody who might have a perspective. The panel on theological education meets twice a year, primarily to give away money, but not exclusively for that purpose. And I have been grateful to be invited to sit at that table. And I've been saying this at that table because it only meets twice a year for a really limited period of time, but it includes the UUA and the UUMA and the presidents of the theological schools and other stakeholders. And I don't think that's a broad enough table still, but it's a beginning and one of the only few that I know that exists across our various organizations and institutions. So I do think that may be part of the piece of the puzzle, certainly because the table exists and because there's funding. And I'm wondering if we could make some kind of collective request to the panel to invest in some kind of container for a broader conversation. Who should be participating? How big the container? I don't know all the answers, but I do share the question and it's one I've been raising. Sarah, what do you have anything you might want to add?
No, I kind of agree with that direction. Melissa, I've been actually kind of promoting that idea that we need such a big effort towards a conversation that invites in a lot of voices. Again, I mean, these have happened periodically during the Commission on Institutional Change, had some really good gatherings of colleagues who talked about, you know, what exactly the kinds of issues you raised there, Matthew. We've had two state of the ministry summits in the last probably 6 or 7 years. And then during the Sinkford years, there was that Excellence in Ministry Summit that raised similar questions back then. But I think it's time for a new effort. We have a new president coming in. So I imagine that Sophia will have some thoughts about that. And I look forward to seeing, you know, what kind of comes to fruit under her leadership.
Thank you. Ruben, and then hopefully Anya, and then we'll be ending today.
I had more of a comment, and I'm jumping a little bit backwards Tara, some of your comments and some of the other comments that I've seen in the stream there. Is it's not only, particularly in today's political climate, it's not only, you know, young people entering ministry who have no families. I think we have to take seriously and really address that if you were asking anyone who is themselves gender diverse, trans, non-binary, or has children who are to move to a state where it would become illegal or in some a felony for them to access care for themselves or their children, we cannot ask them to go, or we have to find some way, and I don't know how yet, and this is the world that I, you know, live and work in, to protect them from literally having their families ripped apart and having them imprisoned for healthcare. And so I think that's some of what we have to look at when we look at the pool of people that are there and the reality that we have trouble getting, you know, our out trans and gender diverse ministers into settled ministry and keeping them, is it's beyond just the conversations. It's not only the exhaustion from having to be the person that is both the educator and spiritual leader and target. It's also literally health and safety. And that has to be part of this conversation and not taken for granted. There is no guarantee. I mean, it's one of the reasons I will not leave Massachusetts, just flat out, because at least I know that my family is safe here and I can get care for my kid. And I'm not going anywhere else, no matter how fabulous the offer is, if I would be jailed, my family would be ripped apart, or my child would be harmed. And I think it's really crucial for us to look at, because it is deeply wounding an entire group of people as a political bludgeon right now, and we can't be silent on it. So I think that's part of what has to be in that attractiveness of luring families away.
Thank you.
And while this is just one tiny piece of that puzzle, I just want to make sure everyone here knows that the UUA's health plan will pay for people to, Richard, can you give the terms of this, but will pay for people to have to travel for medical care. So if you are currently in a situation where you live in a state where either reproductive or gender affirming care is not available, we have made that change in the plan to make that available, at least to our plan members. It's not everything, but it's one thing.
In fact, it's any medical issue. We'll pay, if you can't get appropriate care within 100 miles of your residence, we'll pay travel and hotel expenses within limits, of course, but we'll pay expenses for folks to get the necessary medical care that they need. If you're on the UUA health plan, sorry.
Thank you, Richard, for that response, and Sarah, and especially for the very, very important comments you offered. Ruben, Anya, I think you get the last comment or question.
Yeah, thank you. It's been intriguing to me listening to the conversation and thinking about how I've always imagined that justice work needs someone who's embedded in a community, in the sense of deeply connected in a space and place with people in multiple different groups. And it just got me thinking about how can you engage in an embedded way in a community from a remote ministry? And I think that it's possible, but I think that there's some thinking around that I could use to imagine that for other colleagues or even for myself in that sort of a situation. Because I think that the justice work that we do right now, as we just heard from that last comment, is so essential for us to be doing for ourselves and for the wider communities that we're a part of, and how difficult that is when embeddedness in a community is dangerous or impossible because it's difficult to relocate. I just lift that up.
Thank you, Anya. The conversation has scarcely begun, and yet our time has come to an end. So I really want to sincerely thank you all for being here today and what I know is an extraordinarily busy time of year and really trying circumstances for many. And to assure you that at the UUMA, and I know that at the UUA as well, like we are very closely and carefully considering how we can do our best work to support evolving ministry in a time that's changing faster than we can keep track of. So your comments today are going to be so helpful for all of us as we keep thinking about what comes next. And I know so many people asked questions about sharing the material, so I will take responsibility for sending a communication with the recording and whether or not we have permissions for what to all of you. And to keep you appraised of what further opportunities to continue the conversation may be available. Sarah's going to close us in prayer.
I ask everyone to just, either with your spirits or with your hands, just reach out to your colleagues right now. Dear, dear colleagues, you are a blessing. May you also be blessed in these times when so much is in flux and there are so many challenges and so many demands and so many fears and so much love and so many responsibilities. May your spirits be refreshed by the power of this gathering, but through the prayers of your colleagues. May we be here for one another. And we maybe draw from that deepest well within us, among us, and beyond us. Ashe, and go in peace. Amen.
And thanks again to Joanna Lubkin for tech support and to Jan Taddeo for collegial care assistant support and to all of you.